All right, when we last left Abraham, he was childless, and so he remains. Nabokov has this really nice passage in one of his books, in The Defense, which is a book about chess. And he talks about how there's a famous game. It's called the Immortal Game between two 19th century chess players, Anderson and Kaiseretsky. And what it amounts to is Anderson, who was a great chess player, makes a whole series of sacrifices based on a very subtle mistake that Kaiseretsky makes. So he sacrifices both his rooks, he sacrifices his queen, and eventually he checkmates him. And Nabokov has this very nice passage about poor Kaiseretsky, how he's doomed to make that mistake again and again and again and again throughout history, because every student who studies the game sooner or later plays the immortal game, and poor Kaiseretsky can't just make the mistake once. You know, every time a student studies the game, he makes it over and over again. So, I didn't even bring my chumash. Thank you. Can I borrow yours? I brought the wrong book. But if anybody needs a copy of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations that I grabbed off the shelf, be happy to. I want to borrow it from someone who has someone next to them with a chumash. So is there anyone here? Take. What?
He knows everything by heart.
Yes, right, exactly. Sure. But you know, actually, even if you know, for example, the prayers by heart, according to Jewish law, you're still supposed to use a prayer book, because it's hubris. It's showing off to stand there without a prayer book. And also because, you know, as smart as you may be, human memory is fallible. And you might miss something or forget something, or so you're still supposed to have a prayer book. It's not always observed, but that's the way it's supposed to be. So having said that, anyway, so Abraham is still childless, and Sarah has not been able to give him a child. And of course, here it's both, I mean, in different ways, it is a problem for both of them. Because for Abraham, he's got nobody to carry on his legacy. And for Sarah, she's failed. Right? I mean, it's the ancient world. It's not like she's going to go out and get a law degree. The whole idea is she is supposed to provide him with children. Not only that, but they're the promised of God, so she's got to provide him with children. What's the point of the continuity of the people? And here, it's worth reminding ourselves who Hagar is. Hagar is Sarah's property. She's not a separate person who happens to be, you know, it's not one of those cases where, growing up, I used to hear this all the time. You still hear it sometimes. A family, someone will be serving a family, and you'll be over there for dinner, and they'll say, oh, you know, Florence is really a member of the family. Aren't you, Florence? And she'll say, yes, Mrs. Cohen, right? So it's not one of those instances where Hagar is a member of the family, but she's not really. It's one of those instances where she is a shifcha, a maidservant, which doesn't have sort of the genteel, it's not, you know, a Merchant Ivory movie. It's not that she wears a nice frilly uniform and, you know, and lives below and talks with the other servants. She's a slave. And so you understand why, if Sarah's slave gives Abraham a child, then Sarah's giving him a child. That's what, and this is what the traditional commentators use to explain why Sarah was righteous, because when she gets upset at her, as we'll see, their assumption is that it's because Hagar acted in a way unbecoming her position as a slave. Right? Now, how we feel about Avram and Sarah having slaves, we can get to in a minute, but anyway. What's that? Well, Hagar was a princess according to the Midrash. It doesn't say that in the Torah. Right? The Midrash says that she was Pharaoh's daughter. And that she, you know, and Pharaoh wanting her to have a nice upbringing, sends her to Abraham and Sarah so that she should learn how to behave. But the Torah doesn't say that. All the Torah says about her is that she had an Egyptian maidservant. Right? It doesn't say she had an Egyptian princess or that she grew up in Pharaoh's palace or any of that. Now, you understand the other reason why Hagar as a princess was a popular tradition, because in Islam, she's Ishmael's mother. So she obviously has to have some kind of lineage. But in terms of this story in the Torah, just know that the princess idea is an idea that is, let's say, read between the lines, right? It's not mentioned in the Torah itself. Okay. Now, remember, the last chapter was the promise of the covenant to Abraham, and part of it was, of course, that he'll have children, and so this chapter begins by reminding us that that has not happened. Sarai, their names still have not been changed, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. Chapter 16, sorry. Chapter 16, or if you're using the Bartletts, no, I'm just... They're so funny. They're right next to me on the shelf, and I looked, and I saw it was 8:20, and I grabbed the book and ran. I have these two books, both leather-bound books about the same size, standing right next to each other on the shelf. So I grabbed this one instead of that one. Okay. Okay, everybody have chapter 16? Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant, whose name was Hagar. Now, a shivcha, a handmaiden, she's later called an ama. The two terms mean the same thing. And while it may have some slight nuanced difference with eved, with slave, the way the Israelites were slaves in Egypt, she's still her servant. All right. Vatomar and Sarah said to Abram, "Look, the Lord has kept me from bearing. Consort with my maid. Perhaps I'll have a son through her." And Abram heeded Sarai's request. Now, here is an example of how abbreviated the Torah is. I mean, you can't imagine that she just came, you know, over coffee and orange juice. She said, "Listen, I haven't had a kid. Why don't you go sleep with Hagar?" And he said, "Okay." Imagine how much must have gone on here, which is one of the reasons why Midrash is so powerful and popular, because there's so much to fill in. What drove Sarah to this request? She obviously, first of all, there is behind this a certain loss of faith, right? She doesn't believe she's ever going to have a kid, because if she ever believed it, she certainly wouldn't tell Abraham to have sex with the maid, which is what it comes down to. But in addition to that, he just acquiesces. Why?
God says, "Listen to Sarah."
Well, God says, "Listen to Sarah" later. God does say, "Listen to Sarah," but he doesn't say it yet. What?
He told him you'd conceive a child.
Right. My assumption is, what's that? He's desperate to have a child. I mean, my assumption is that he's as uncertain of God's promise as Sarah is. God doesn't say to him, "You're going to have a child through Sarah." God just says, "You'll have a child." So maybe this is the way, right? He doesn't know. He finds out later from God, yeah.
Right. She's hoping, she's going to build it up.
Okay, does this tell you anything else about Abraham? Yes. Because God gives Eve to Adam in that way? Is that what you're thinking? Oh, I see what you mean. That Adam listens to Eve the same way Abraham listens to Sarah. There's certainly the same dynamic. That is, the husband just does, you know, what the wife says without any comment whatsoever. Adam doesn't say anything. Eve doesn't say anything. What Eve says is a direct contradiction of what God wants. Sarah, I don't think, knows that here. I don't think Sarah thinks I'm disobeying God, but it turns out to be, in fact, different from what God wants. So, yes, I think this is probably, if we thought about this more, we could probably come up with a fruitful way of thinking about what the connection is here. Yeah.
Could this be any way related to the traditions of Sarah's people?
Sarah's a, remember that Sarah is a relative of Abraham's. So if it's related to the traditions of her people, it's got to be related to the traditions of his too. It does also, by the way, in the ancient Near East, it wasn't uncommon to have, as we see later on, children. Don't forget Yaakov. He has kids not only with Rachel and Leah, but also with Bilhah and Zilpah, who are their handmaids. And they become 12 tribes of Israel. So not only does it happen, but it doesn't seem like it's so terrible. It also, I think, tells you something about Abram, which is he's not really, he does not in this exchange have what they call a high EQ, that is emotional, right, intelligence quotient, if he really thinks that this is going to be fine. Yes, right. She also is being, maybe she misjudges Hagar, but both of them are not taking into account, maybe because they never had children and they're desperate and they don't realize how upending children are. They're very naive about the consequences of this. Yeah.
Using your phrase that we know very little except the words, yeah. To me, the most important phrase in the bucket ball of Torah, to me, is when God said to Abraham, leave. And Abraham left. We have known. He took bag and baggage and went. He had no connection with his emotional attachment. He knew to do. It was an absolute obedient will. In the time of having to foster children and nationhood, it is conceivable to me, no pun intended, that Abraham understood the word of God through Sarah. And understood the importance of lineage. And on something, if he could make the move that he made earlier, which is how we began, then this would be in line with his character. I don't think that he would need, given that they lived together, a long debate. He knew his duty, he knew the commandment, and he did it when asked.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, is there any possibility there were conversations that preceded this? You know, maybe Abraham said to her the previous day, I don't know what we're going to do. You know, all I know is we're supposed to have kids and we don't have kids. And the assumption is going to be, in fact, someone just said this to me a couple days ago in my office, that there was a couple and they couldn't have children. And of course, they assumed it was the wife. Didn't even occur to them that it was the husband. Right. So the assumption here was going to be that it was Sarah. And as it turns out, in a way it is Sarah, but it's God's doing. So it may be that Abraham initiated this days before. Who knows? It's one of those crucial conversations, like the conversation, by the way, between Cain and Abel, that is completely up for Midrashic fill-in. I mean, you can imagine. You know, you could have, if it weren't this kind of situation, it's the kind of incident where you could have kids in a classroom write the dialogue and see what they came up with. But this is probably not the best thing to pick. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that they have been putting off doing this practice because
I actually.
And so this was like a last resort.
I think that that's probably what it was. I think it probably was a last resort. I don't think Sarai came to this until she absolutely had to. Also in the recognition, I think they're clearly older. She knows that there's a limit to his fertility too. After all. You know, I mean, he's got to sleep with Hagar while he can still sleep with Hagar. And though it's obviously possible, I mean, like Saul Bellow had a kid in his 80s. It doesn't, you know, it's not inconceivable that Avraham will be fertile until he dies. It's also not inconceivable that he won't be.
And
so.
Also, keeping that in mind, let's say they are all much very mature people at this point, lived through all kinds of stuff. Like, they do this final resort, and now they have this young girl
who's
uppity with them. It's like.
Well, we haven't gotten to that yet, but she's about to write. That's the other. I was just about to say she still doesn't know all this is going on, but that presumes that she doesn't know all this is going on. But who knows? Who knows what she could have said to either Sarah or to Abraham? Because it sounds like this is her chance to have a kid too. If she's alone in that house and Abraham is the only man, then if she can't somehow persuade them to have Abraham have a child with her, she doesn't get a child either. So who knows what Hagar said to whom? It's very intriguing. But there clearly are three players here, and sometimes the one offstage is the one who pulls the strings. You don't know, in addition to God. And if the Midrash is reflecting any kind of real tradition that Hagar was not just a maidservant but had some kind of high birth, then she's going to be that much more insistent that she have a child, right, that she's... Anyway. Okay, so... Now... Notice that when it says, when Abraham says that he's going to have relations with Hagar, it's Sarah who does it. Because the next phrase is, V'tikach Sarai. Sarah takes Eshet Avraham, the wife of Abraham. Okay, just so you shouldn't forget her position for a second. This is Abraham's wife who is doing this. What does she take? She takes Hagar Hamitzrit Shivchata. And because the Bible doesn't use many words, it's worth paying attention to each word that it does use. First of all, it establishes her position, that she did the taking, no one else, right? And then Et Hagar, she takes Hagar. Et is not a, you can't translate it into English. It's a participle in Hebrew that's just, I would say in Hebrew, I took Et the book. But in English, you don't use that kind of... So anyway, she takes Hagar, Hamitrit, the Egyptian. Now, Egyptians are not, you know, in the Bible, being an Egyptian is a very mixed status. I mean, on the one hand, Egypt is very exalted in the Bible. We know, for example, that Canaan, was ruled by the Egyptians through a lot of its history. It's not, Egypt did not only control Egypt. I mean, so Israelite society was influenced both from Egypt and also from Canaan by Egypt. So Egyptian culture and society and so on is very important. On the other hand, you know, that's where people were enslaved. So the assumption that Hagar was somebody important clearly comes from the fact that they keep calling her Hamitzri. There's no reason to tell us that unless it's telling us something about her status or origin. But then it says, Hamitzrit Shivchata, again, her maidservant. She's Eshet Avraham, Hagar is the maidservant. It's very important that we understand that hierarchical relationship, who's in charge and who's not. Okay, and this is after they've been in Canaan for 10 years, which tells you that they've been trying for a long time. Right? That's what it's not. Didn't happen the first week. It didn't happen the first month. And she gave her to Abraham. Now it says le'isha, which is the same word that you use for a wife. But I don't know that there's another word, and that's probably why they translate it as concubine. Isha means woman. It also means wife. Right. It means both. Yeah. So maybe he gave her to her as a woman. And then it says, and this is also, I'm sorry, didn't hear. Oh, okay. Also, notice right away, Vayavo el Hagar, he came to Hagar, which is another way of saying that he slept with her, and immediately she gets pregnant. Right away, 10 years on the one hand with Sarah, sounds like one night with Hagar. And that's all it took. Now, one of the things that this tells you is that I think in the context of the Bible that somehow this is supposed to be, right? It's not against God's design or it wouldn't happen so instantly. But also it's painful for Sarah. One would think, after all this waiting, the next day, Avram comes in and says, I slept with her, and soon, she's pregnant. Yeah. Actually, the 21st century answer is yes, but I think the ancient answer is no. Because it's not what makes her more jealous is not that her husband slept with someone else, but that her husband had a kid with someone else. Because that's really her purpose as a wife is not to sleep with her husband, but to have kids with her husband.
So Sarah's actually in a no-win situation.
Yep.
But just as a thought, do you think it's possible that Sarah would have been
happier
as well? Because it wasn't said that she was supposed to do what she did.
Right. And then that forces God's hand?
God's
hand. Maybe it's a nice idea, except that it's a risky game, because maybe God will say, okay, so let's go with Ishmael, you know? Which some people think he did, obviously. That's why I mentioned this last week to someone. That's why I was on a panel a couple of times at UCLA. This guy put together a group called Children of Abraham, which brought together Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, you know, clergy to talk about faith issues. And the reason they're Children of Abraham is Abraham is the only figure that arouses no opposition in terms of his teaching to the three monotheistic faiths. Everybody's okay with Abraham, right? They think his legacy is different, but everybody's okay with Abraham, Christian, Jewish, Muslim. Yeah. So the Oscar Wilde said there are two tragedies in life, not getting what you want and getting what you want. So I think that it's a case of that. Yes, she really did want that, but at the same time, it's so painful to see that here's this child and it's Hagar's. And also, as we'll see, Hagar felt that way too, but I'm sure that it has to be very difficult. In the same way that... you can be selfless and want something good for someone that doesn't involve you, but when they get it, you still feel a pang. So, yeah. Go ahead. Right. Well, but she sees Hagar fulfilling this biological function that she's unable to fulfill.
But I guess what I'm going to say is that everything is so new, this whole situation now, it's literally in her face. And
Hagar... I mean, you can just imagine this, especially when you look at the second half of the verse, where it says, you know, and Hagar was lowered in her esteem, right? You can just imagine Sarai saying, you know, Go do the dishes, and she'll say, you know, I can't really get up now. I'm sorry, the baby's kicking. Okay. So it's not, it can't be easy, yeah. You might be right. She just did what a good wife would do, and then it backfired because it actually worked, and she hoped it wouldn't work. I could easily see that. That she had, this was her obligation, but she sure didn't want it to come off. I just want to say, this has been four verses, and you hear how many possibilities are in this, even from just whatever, 15 to whatever, a half hour of looking at it. When the rabbis, that's why there's so much midrash. That's why the rabbis pore over this again and again, day after day, year after year, without all the other distractions that are in our lives. And they continually deepen and imagine what all these interactions might have been. I guess that you could see any one of the three as the person who makes this go. You could see it as Sarai, which is the way the text seems to present it, but you could clearly see it as Hagar, or you could see it as Abram. If you see it as Sarai or Hagar, then it's a sort of classical picture of Abraham being manipulable, right, in the way that men are manipulable. What's that? It depends who you ask. It depends who you ask. It depends who you ask. I've had many women tell me the equivalent of, it takes about, you know, I don't know, a week, a month to plant an idea in their husband's head long enough so that their husband thinks it's their idea. And it just takes, you know, and that's because he welcomed that idea or just because he's really unaware of the fact that I actually think that human beings, forget men, women, human beings can clearly be manipulated at times in ways, not that they want or don't want, but that they're unaware of, that they're being manipulated. They think it originates from them. That's what it means to be manipulated, right? Is you don't think, oh, this person's trying to get me to do something. Now I have to decide if I want to or not. But rather, yeah, I do want to do that. Remember Tom Sawyer? This great scene in Tom Sawyer where he has to whitewash the fence. And he really hates doing it. But he makes it sound like something he doesn't want to let anyone else do because it's so wonderful. And then, of course, everybody wants to do it. Now, it's a burdensome task, but he manipulates them just by making them think that it's their idea that they want to do it. So, anyway. Okay, so whoever's doing the manipulating here, they've done it well. Or badly, if Sarai was doing it in the hope that she would just come out looking good, but not with a kid. All right. That she was lowered in her esteem. Again, this is what the commentators use to excuse Sarai's subsequent behavior. That is, you know, she can't continue having Hagar around if she's going to treat her poorly. So Sarai says to Abram, "The wrong done me is your fault." Now, remember, those of you who were in the class before, remember that the rabbis came up with a clever way of excusing this, which is when Abram says to God, look at the chapter 15, verse 3. Right, the previous chapter, what does Abram say to God? Hain li no natata zera. You didn't give me children, Abram says to God. So the rabbis say, Sarah says it's your fault, because had you said to God you didn't give us children, maybe God would have given us children. But instead what you said was you didn't give me children, so God answered your request and left me out of it. Which is, now, that means Sarai must have been listening at the keyhole probably when Abram was saying this to God. But the reason that the rabbis do that is because they're trying to find a justification for Sarai, who seems to have set this whole thing in motion, to then turn to Abram and say, it's your fault. Although, again, on a human level, you can understand this. Yeah. Yes. So even though na is please, it is a particle that means please. So even though she says, come on, please, just take Hagar, she really wanted him to say no. Maybe. Right. Maybe, but yeah, although this is a wife talking to a husband, but whether you can peg it on the language or not, and maybe you can, it's a really nice idea that the whole point of Sarah saying this was so that Abram could say no. Right? That's why she asked. And you all, again, everybody here knows that some questions are asked so that the other person can say, no, I would never, never, I wouldn't do that. Yeah.
When we talk about, it seems to me that the three people involved, that the ideas don't come from a single person. This is a very Western idea, an individualistic idea, that what happens in the world is either mine or yours,
right,
or somebody else's.
It's a nice point.
The ideas come from the group stuff going on, and it seems to me to be very profound here, is God's relationship is to all three of them, which is very different for all three of them, but that he has one to all three of them. What's really profound for me here is that Hagar, as the maid, because, you know, if you're going to be a slave, what's your relationship to a monotheistic God?
And we'll see, by the way, a little later on, that she clearly has one, as they do.
Deep,
right.
People, and what your role in life, and what your role happens to be in life, how do you deal with being the non-chosen one is just as important as how do you deal with being the chosen one.
Hmm.
And Abraham and Sarai here are still not chosen in the way their names aren't changed yet, their characters in this thing. And so it seems to me that it's much more deep than who did what to whom and what's got to be the person in charge. But whenever you see a group of people, it's very hard to know who puts what into whom.
This is like a systems theory of families as opposed to, right.
So
go ahead. So that, well, if you couldn't hear, the comment was that in fact ideas don't arise from one person. They arise from, especially in families and so on, they arise from the system and the different people who are involved and the way it works, like a mobile. You know, you touch one part and everything else goes out of whack, but all of it is implicated in the way that it works. And so here, it's not as though it was Sarai's idea or Abraham's idea or Hagar's idea. Rather, it arose from the situation and the personalities involved, and that each of them has their own relationship with God, who is over the process. So, yeah. It is possible. I mean, that's not how the tradition takes it, obviously, but it may be if you hadn't brought us, you know, if we'd stayed back in Ur-Kasdim. Yeah.
I just think that all these characters are very disappointing characters. You know, Abraham is, you know, has no backbone. His best qualities is compliant and benign. And that's his wife. His wife is manipulative, you know, and sets up the situation, then knocks it down. And Hagar, I still don't know, you know, much about her, but I'm sure she's manipulative on her. You know, so women are basically depicted as manipulative bitches, excuse my language, and men are just benign, no backbone, you know, sweet guy who has no sophistication.
I'm going to say something about that, but go ahead. I'm taking, yes, rebuttal. Rebuttal time, Manny. Go ahead. Right.
The continuity of the people. And she was lacking in her duties to fulfill that promise. So she, I wouldn't say selflessly, but she did try to help him make his dream.
Right.
By providing this maidservant. But she didn't realize, in her, I wouldn't say immaturity, but I mean her, she was naive, that Abraham would be happy.
Hmm.
See that continuity.
It's true that if she had seen the light in his eyes, I'm sure that must have been hard.
And I think that's where she just, her heart just dropped. You just saw the emotion, the connection with the father and son.
I do want to say two things about this, about the character of the individuals. First of all, remember that we're still early in the story. There's still a lot to go, and they'll reveal a lot about themselves along the way. But the other part of it is that I actually find that very encouraging. That in order to be a hero, in order to be chosen, in order to do God's work in this world, you don't have to be perfect. Because if you do, then we're in trouble. But all the heroes of the Bible have serious flaws, but they still do God's work. I mean, Abram really does God's work. Sarah really does God's work. Moses, who clearly has, David, God knows David's got flaws, he still does God's work, which is much better, I think, than there being perfect paragons. But there's more. There is more to come. We'll see. Yeah, one, two. Go ahead.
In the Babylonian culture, which they came from, right, wherever, right, back in Haran or wherever, maybe the maidservants there would, when you sleep with the husband, that custom, the maidservants kept their place.
Right. Well, that's clear. Right. It might be in Egypt. It might have been different. One of the, we definitely suffer from a lack of more knowledge. And I'll have to look at Speiser, see what he says about this. It would be nice if we knew more, right, about how maidservants normally function in Babylonia and Egypt.
Well, you know about Sabina Tubal, who recently passed away, and her two books on Sarah.
Yeah, but I haven't read them. So,
I really recommend it because it really is an in-depth analysis of
this
pieces. And it's the only one from a woman's point of view, which is actually archaeologically, I've talked to archaeologists who think this really solid.
Yeah.
Right, that Sarah would
have. No, it's a work of a biblical scholar who's writing. Yeah, go ahead, 1 second. Yes.
Isn't she really upset because her maid all of a sudden became her husband's mistress?
Yeah, but she said. I want to finish, let's finish this one sentence. I myself, because we haven't heard Sarah's whole complaint, right? The wrong done me is your fault. I myself put my maid in your bosom. Now that she sees that she's pregnant, I'm lowered in her esteem. The Lord decide between you and me. Now, I'll tell you what I see in this. What I see in this is, it's your job, since you got her pregnant, to make sure she doesn't treat me badly. It's not my job. And in fact, the next sentence, Abraham says basically, all right, do whatever you want. Because he doesn't want that job, right? He says, your maid's in your hands, deal with her as you think right. What I think Sarah felt was, you went, you got her pregnant, certainly you had a good time, and then you abandon all responsibility, like it was just my job to take care of her and make sure that she did everything she was supposed to do. But because of what you did, she's treating me badly. So, I mean, that's, I read it as exactly his abdication of what she thinks is his responsibility. But you can understand why that would happen, because up to now, he's probably never said two words to Hagar. She's Sarah's handmaid, right? Not his. So he doesn't see his relationship to her having changed. Yeah, so I slept with her to have a kid, but that doesn't change my social relationship to her. She's a handmaid, and she's Sarah's handmaid. Yeah.
But he falls in love.
He falls in love?
Perhaps he falls in love.
Oh, perhaps. I would say the only way, it seems to me far-fetched that he falls in love. Especially, you should forgive me for saying this, but from sleeping with her for one night. I don't think, unless it's the movies, I think it's less than likely that single act, he may want her again, but it's not the same as falling in love with her.
Compartmentalize
it. Right. Well, he's a man. That's what men do. That's how they're built.
I think there are other things.
You don't think? Is that an arguable statement? I don't even believe. You really think that men don't compartmentalize more than women?
Yeah, I think they do.
Okay, so what are you hissing me for?
Because there are a group of women who won't acknowledge that men can and do learn integration.
Of course they will. You acknowledge that, don't you?
No,
yeah,
don't.
There you go. All right, however, having said that, wait, there's still, there is more Torah to learn out of this. Having said that, according to the rabbis, after the Akedah and after the death of Sarah, when Abraham gets married to Keturah and has all these children, that's really Hagar. Yes. They're according to the rabbinic midrash, that's Hagar.
So what?
What's that?
Could be Hagar means only the outsider.
Right. It could be. And Hagar is not her official name. Her real name is Keturah. Now, the reason that the rabbis say that, it's a complicated issue. There was a very famous, in such circles, Midrashic scholar named Heinemann in Israel, who talked about the fact that the rabbis have what they call a flight from anonymity. They don't like individuals in the Bible whom they don't know. When someone comes along, they want to always identify that person with a character who is known. So since they don't know who Keturah is, and all of a sudden Abraham marries her, the only woman that seems like a plausible candidate is Hagar. But all I can say is it possible that he fell in love with Hagar? It's possible, but there is no subsequent indication other than that he feels bad about sending her and his kid out of the house. Yeah. What's that? Excuse me. Yeah. It doesn't. We don't know. It's just that it says Vayavo El Hagar, which means he came to Hagar Vatahar, and she got pregnant. So it's possible that it was one night. Yeah. Yes. Whereas we, on the other hand, we understand women so well. And it's just ironic that they can't get us. I don't get it. Right. No. Yes. Okay. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, this reminds me a little bit of the wife of Job. In the book of Job, he's suffering. And his wife says to him at some point, curse God and die. And I always, when I study the book of Job with groups, I always ask them, okay, is she good or bad? And you get a very split response. And after everybody's done, I always say to them, okay, your response to Job's wife has nothing to do with Job's wife and everything to do with you. You could see any one of these three, anyone, as the instigator, the manipulator, the selfish one, the inconsistent one. And the question is that you have to ask yourself, why do I read the story this way and not that way? Because you've just heard, it seems to me, equally all of them, ingenious, equally plausible readings about who the instigator is. And I don't have an answer for why. I mean, my initial response, which I would defend on the basis of the fact that the text here seems clearly to say Sarah is the instigator. But as you've just all proved, you could easily switch that around. My initial response was to say that this was what Sarah wanted, but it wasn't. But then when she got it, she realized she didn't really want it. But you could see it as Abraham, you could see it as Hagar, you could see it as all three of them in some kind of, you know, alchemical combination, any one of them. So I don't know what to tell you, except that what seems to me to be clear is that when people don't get what they want and find another way to produce what they want that's really radically different, it never fits into the original, you know, into the original desire. It just doesn't. I mean, the only way that Sarai is going to get a kid the way she wants is to get a kid the way she wants. And when she tries to do something that's the same but different, you know, it's the law of unintended consequences. She didn't mean for this to happen, but it was, something was going to go wrong when she tried to do it this way. And it's also not, I'm sure that there are equivalent stories in, for example, the stories of slavery in the South. I have no doubt that there were wives who said to husbands, well, if you can't have a kid with me, have a kid with a slave, and it led to all sorts of, you know, difficulty, in addition to husbands who just did that. But I'm talking about, I'm sure there were equivalent situations. Yeah.
What is it in the country? What does this have to do with destiny and free will?
Well, the question that always recurs is, did God want this to happen or did they do it on their own? And the answer to that is, yeah. So, I mean, it seems, you know, this is a question that we continually bump up against, and I think that it's impossible to answer definitively in any one of the various instances. Obviously, in some way, God is superintending this process, because God says to them, you're going to have a child. And then God intervenes and promises them a child, specifically to Sarah and Abram. But in the meantime, all sorts of things can happen that are just humanly. Right. No.
And that's why I say, well, when we are faced with these things, with
right.
our own idea, we're thinking, is this what I'm supposed to do, or
yep.
what do I want to do?
I know. That's hard to disentangle what you're supposed to do and what you want to do.
Don't you think Sarah's doing that too?
I'm sure that she was. And also what I don't know is to what extent Sarah bought into Abraham's mission. You know? I mean, she went with him. She traveled with him. She passed herself off as his sister instead of his wife. Don't forget, she's gone through a lot, Sarah, to get where she got just to see him have a kid with someone else. This is where you can, if you want to see Sarah as the long-suffering wife, you can clearly see Abraham as the individualistic, selfish, self-anointed, Messiah complex. He's got to do God's work. And it's too bad if it injures everyone around him, you know? That's what it means to be, you can just hear him. So that's what it means to be married to me, dear. You know, I'm Abraham, and I'm God's chosen. You know, who knows? You could certainly see that that would be possible. But it doesn't say.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the real player here, in a way. It's Ishmael.
Who's the real player?
Ishmael.
I don't think Ishmael did this. I really don't. I got to say, if there's one person who's off the hook.
Out of this dysfunctional family.
Yes. Right.
Comes this prince of men who's going to be a leader of great nations. The story is not a trivial story. It's not Aaron
Stone.
And the choice that was made then and how we Jews have treated or not treated Ishmael, we're paying for or in mixed.
That is, I think that's a big stretch and a long later issue. Don't forget, Islam didn't arise until the 7th century. That is a good, 2,000 years after these events are supposed to happen. So
we're still celebrating the destruction of the temples.
That may well be, but I'm saying to assume that the way we treated Ishmael has anything to do with anything, when in fact Ishmael wasn't seen as the progenitor of Islam until 2,000 years later, it's just covering a large gap of history.
When you met with the Christian and the Muslim on that panel,
we didn't talk about this story. No. So they wouldn't get into this because this is not, you have to look at how it's told in the Quran. I don't know. But, I mean, you have to check that story because that doesn't matter how it's told in the Hebrew Bible for a Muslim. The Hebrew Bible is an imperfect version.
It seems to me that that this is the Hebrew Bible, if you look at Cahill or any of that, is about individuation and individuals. And the system.
Among many other things, yes.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is that we seem to get into an either-or way of looking at that. So when I brought the systems approach, it doesn't take away the individual. You
right.
can take any individual in the system and carry them through. But when you said a couple of weeks ago about Sarah, we are looking at this, if we look at who is our only ancestor, it would be Sarah, and Abraham is the ancestor of many people. I think that this is really profound. I think what Erwin is saying is not God works through a long period of time. So even if the consequences in the human mind are that Ishmael is the father of so many people and it didn't happen for a long time, I guess I'm still struggling where I am as a student here of how does God work?
I was reacting to the way we've treated Ishmael stuff, which is, I mean, because the truth is that for most of Jewish history, Jews didn't treat Ishmael one way or another because there wasn't an identifiable Ishmael. And once there was, it's a very complicated history, and I certainly don't think that we've been mostly culpable. But having said that, yes, it's clear. Don't forget that God says you will be the father of great nations, Abraham. So Abraham is the father of great nations. And Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, which we'll get to eventually, that's the model for the sacrifice of Jesus, don't forget. I mean, when Jesus carries the cross, it's because Isaac carried the wood up to the Mount Moriah. And Jesus is the Lamb of God, and Isaac was the Sela Olah, was the lamb that was going to be sacrificed. So Abraham is deeply implicated in all the stories of the monotheistic faiths. And this is, I agree, this is a pivotal turning point in that history, which makes it that much more intriguing who you think is the greatest motive force here. But I don't think Ishmael is the consequence, though, not the force. I would say the only way that you could say that Ishmael is the force instead of the consequence is if you think it was written subsequently by those who for whom Ishmael was important.
If I could personalize it for a moment, I was abandoned by my father. I carried that for a long time. Abraham is very mean to Hagar, and he sent them off at a
We haven't gotten to that yet, but yes.
I mean, he was a rich man.
Right.
He could have sent them with guards and people to protect him.
We'll come to that. Hold on to that because that's important.
Wasn't too happy with this
right.
Man.
I can't imagine that Ishmael was thrilled, no. But that's why I say it would be interesting to see how the Quran tells the same story, because I don't know that it tells it the same way. I just don't. I know it tells the Akedah differently. I don't actually know how it tells the birth and expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael. But Sarai is, I mean, I love Sarai's last line, you know, Yishpot Adonai Beini Uveinecha. God's going to decide between you and me, which shows that she really believes that she's on the side of the angels here, not that she was manipulative and mean and so on, but that Abraham did her wrong, and that she, right, and that God is going to get him for it, as God is supposed to, and Abraham backs away, and let's do this verse last. Abraham said to Sarai, your maid's in your hands, deal with her as you think right. Sarai treated her harshly, and she ran away from her. So, yes.
Why did she say north will judge between me and you?
Because she's saying you may not think that it's your fault, but you'll see. God will judge. She's appealing to it's the only court of appeal she has, right?
So they're accusing each other.
It seems to me implicit, although maybe not. It seems to me implicit. You know, when you get in an argument with someone and you're absolutely convinced you're right, you wish there was someone else there who could just, you know, say, someone who could observe the argument would say, what's the matter with you? She's obviously right. Why don't you listen to her? That's, you know, that's why we raise children. Yes. The point of contention is that she's lowered in Hagar's esteem, it seems. Now that she's pregnant, I'm lowered in her esteem.
So that means that
Abraham should have done that. Abraham should have done, should not have allowed that in his home. I'm guessing, okay? And this will require more, I'm going to look to see how else this is interpreted this week. But I could see it this way. I couldn't have a child. I made this great sacrifice. I gave my handmaiden to you. You got her pregnant, and now you're allowing her to treat me like this. How could you do that to me? After I gave everything up for you so that you could have a child, she's treating me badly, and you're not saying a word. You're the same old bump on a log, you know? So that's my guess. But I don't know. He may be acting just the same. He never controlled the house before, and he doesn't control the house now. My guess is he probably had nothing to do with the domestic arrangements, and he still doesn't have anything to do with the domestic arrangements, but she's saying you are now implicated in them. You just had a child with this woman. Yeah.
You know, the way I read it is God decided that he needed a child.
Except that Yishpot Elohim is more a wish than a previous fact.
But I don't know.
Yeah, but that's an interesting thought.
I thought that, you know, he chose,
Right, he chose you.
He's being the child, not him.
Last comment. Yeah. Keter is crown, so maybe Keturah means crown. That may be where you get the Egyptian princess idea. It probably is from Keturah. Good thought. Yes. Okay. Next time.